loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we'll talk about what some are calling the legislative coup that is taking place in Wisconsin that seeks to lock in right-wing policies and negate the results of the 2018 election. And then we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice that happens every Thursday here at Loud and Clear, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the chief financial officer of Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications equipment and consumer tech giant, was arrested in Canada at U.S. request. The Trump administration wants her to be extradited to face trial on charges of violating sanctions on Iran, but Huawei's business in Iran is perfectly legal under international law and under the terms of the JCPOA, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from. Next, the funeral of former President George H.W. Bush was held yesterday in Washington, and his body was returned to Texas, where he will be interred today. Every day this week, we're talking about the Bush legacy. Today, we discuss Bush's response to the AIDS crisis. Then, it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And then, global carbon emissions rose by 2.7% this year, following a 1.6% increase last year. Scientists blame strong economies in India and China and say that those countries are burning more coal and the middle classes there are buying more and more cars, but per capita carbon emissions remain highest by far in Europe and the United States. They also say that we have passed a point of no return on carbon emissions and climate change. And finally, two independent academics at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies will soon release a report in which they conclude that North Korea is expanding two missile bases that could be used to house long-range ballistic missiles. South Korean military officials said that they are monitoring the situation in cooperation with the United States. There have been no formal announcements by any party. And in other headlines, a bipartisan resolution has been introduced in the Senate that blames Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and criticizes other aspects of Saudi government policy. Republicans Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, and Todd Young, and Democrats Dianne Feinstein, Ed Markey, and Chris Coons jointly introduced the resolution. This move follows a briefing with top senators conducted by CIA Director Gina Haspel. Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno announced today that Britain has guaranteed not to extradite Julian Assange to any country where his life would be in danger. Activists fear that this could be a precursor to Assange's expulsion from the embassy. Assange has lived in the Ecuadorian embassy for over 6 years, and a U.S. court recently unintentionally revealed a sealed indictment against him, although it's unclear what the charges are. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced today that Russia is investing $6 billion in Venezuelan oil and gold mining interests. This announcement came after President Maduro's trip to Moscow for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Venezuela is currently facing sanctions imposed by the United States. International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde said today that despite stock volatility and market unsteadiness, she doesn't see, quote, the elements of recession in short order, unquote. She called concerns a little bit overdone and was optimistic about the current 90-day negotiation window between the U.S. and China. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Wisconsin. Republican lamakers in Wisconsin's lame duck legislature have forced bills into law that will strip the incoming Democratic governor and attorneys general of much of their power. New laws also would throw poor people off Medicaid and shorten voting and voter registration times. And 2 days ago, that same legislature approved 82 of Governor Scott Walker's political appointees with no debate. We're joined from Madison, Wisconsin by Jay Heck. Jay is the executive director of Common Cause Wisconsin. We're also joined from Milwaukee by David Liners. David Liners is the state director of Wisdom, a statewide organization seeking justice and common good. Jay, David, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I was looking, here we are in Washington, D.C. I was also looking at the New York Times. the front page above the fold today. In Wisconsin, a power play for the road, meaning on its way out, the political legislature and the governor on its way out. Just real quick for our audience here in Washington, D.C., what's the essence of what's happened in these remarkable few days?
Well, this is Jay Heck. As your listeners may know, on November 6th, Democrats swept all the statewide constitutional offices. There are actually more votes cast for Democratic state legislators, but yet the Republicans maintained solid majorities in both of the chambers of the Wisconsin legislature, primarily due to hyperpartisan gerrymandering, and have decided that they don't like the outcome of the election and have attempted to strip not only the powers that Governor Walker had away from the new Democratic-elect governor, Tony Evers, but also from the attorney general. They have tried to, they succeeded actually now in cutting back what we call early voting, and then a whole host of other measures. And of course, it has nothing to do with the citizens of Wisconsin, what the citizens need here, better roads, education, funding, all the rest. It's strictly purely partisan, political moves to entrench the Republican leadership in power and make sure that they have the ability to thwart much of the agenda that Governor Evers and the Attorney General Josh Call might want to accomplish over the next at least 2 and possibly 4 years.
That's the voice of Jay Heck. Jay is the Executive Director of Common Cause Wisconsin. We're also joined from Milwaukee by David Liners. David is State Director of Wisdom, a statewide organization seeking justice and common good. Besides the Republican-Democrat struggle, David, what's the social content of this battle to strip the governor and the attorney general of power and the other measures that this outgoing state legislature with the outgoing governor, who Scott Walker, a very famous conservative, they're working in tandem together. What's the content? What's the social content? How will it impact people?
Well, a lot of the things they're trying to make it that the attorney general can't withdraw Wisconsin from the lawsuit against Obamacare, for example. But basically, they're just entrenching the number of people who are going to remain uninsured. They're keeping power away from people to vote early. The early voting is really important, and a lot of people think that's part of why there was this change, that a lot of people voted early this year. So it's a lot of programs that have to do with poor people. It's a lot of they slid in there. One of the issues we work on a lot is criminal justice reform. They slid in this provision basically to try to intimidate the new governor into not instituting any kind of early release or even putting in a pardon, a parole board or a pardon board that would do their jobs. So there's all kinds of ways. But I think the biggest thing is, though, it really, really sours people on government. You know, it's sort of like it just reinforces the narrative that it doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter what we say. It doesn't matter that we turn out to vote because the powers that be are going to figure out a way to take it away from us. And I think that's what's the most disheartening. You know, as Jay said, already the group in the legislature benefits so incredibly by gerrymandering that you have people who got a minority of the votes with a big majority of the seats. You know, they've lost the other offices and they won't give up. I think the other thing is they've taken away power from so many other places already. They've taken away power from local communities to control their own budgets. They've already completely almost wiped out all the power of our state treasurer, of our secretary of state. They just keep concentrating power in their own hands and don't even seem to care about the appearance of fairness at this point. So it's very discouraging, and people become very disheartened and say, this is why, you know, this is why it doesn't matter that we get involved. So it makes our job a lot harder.
We are now joined by Rabbi Bonnie Margulis. She is the president of Wisconsin Faith Voices for Justice. Welcome, Rabbi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I want to ask you if this or anything like this has happened in Wisconsin before. And now that the voters, at least in my mind, have clearly rejected one party in favor of the other, what happens next? The point was just made that you've got a minority party with the majority of seats. You have clear gerrymandering, which has been found unconstitutional in other states. So what happens next in Wisconsin?
Well, what happens next, unfortunately, is that a lot of these bills are going to go straight to the courts. And Governor-elect Evers has said that, you know, all options are on the table, including bringing these bringing lawsuits against these bills, which, you know, is just going to cost the state more money. That's going to be at state expense. It's going to cost taxpayers money to litigate these bills that nobody wants except for the Republican leadership. And, you know, David's absolutely right. It just subverts the will of the people. And I was at the Capitol all day on Monday at the hearings and listening to people, not just their testimony, but also the people who were trying to get into the room to testify. And the level of frustration and just despair, really, among the electorate is palpable. And you know, David's absolutely right. It's going to make our jobs so much harder to mobilize people to vote when their vote is automatically subverted by the Republican leadership, who basically lost the vote and can't take "you lost" for an answer.
Jay Heck, go ahead.
I just want to say that, yes, it's discouraging. On the other hand, there is a great deal of energy and an incredible amount of resentment about what has happened. And we are seeing many, many citizens who are just outraged and are energized to take positive action. And as Rabbi Margolis and David both said, yes, a lot of this is going to be litigated. There'll be a lot of things that will be taken to court. I think the restrictions on early voting, it was before we had the ability to early vote as much as 6 weeks before November 6th, but because of the big Democratic majorities that came out of Milwaukee and Dane County, the Republicans decided they wanted to restrict it to just 2 weeks before November 6th. And that's probably going to be struck down again by a federal court. So some of this stuff, I think, will be sorted out in the courts. But I also think that a lot of citizens are now very energized. And by the way, there's a critical Wisconsin Supreme Court election in April. And I think people will be energized to turn out there. It's critical. A progressive, the former Chief Justice, Shirley Abrahamson, is retiring. So that's going to be a focus, I think, for a lot of progressives to make sure that that seat is not lost. And I don't think we're going to see a let up in the kind of energy that at least I'm seeing from a lot of citizens until straight through to November of 2020.
We are joined from Madison, Wisconsin by Jay Heck. He is the executive director of Common Cause Wisconsin. We're joined from Milwaukee by David Liners. He's state director of Wisdom, a statewide organization seeking justice and common good. And we're also joined from Madison by Rabbi Bonnie Margulies. She is the president of Wisconsin Faith Voices for Justice. Brian, just in 2011, which seems like the other day to me, there was a similar problem in Wisconsin with Governor Walker, and people didn't take it to the ballot box. They took it to the streets.
Yeah, it was an amazing development, and nobody really could see it coming. It wasn't simply the labor movement. Maybe it wasn't even mainly the labor movement, even though it was labor issues that catalyzed that movement. It was a lot of young people, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people. It led to a very long political mobilization and even occupation of the state capitol. I want to pick up, David Liners, on the point that Jay Heck mentioned, which is that while there's frustration and anger, which there must be, there's also energy. And I'm just wondering if we might see a repeat of this combination of people being in the streets, or in that case, in the state capitol building. In other words, grassroots mass mobilization, in addition to or adjacent with efforts at the in the electoral arena.
I think you'll see some. I don't think you'll see anything like 2011 again. I don't think it's going to be that. But I think that people are going to be laser focused on the elections in 2020. I think people are really tired of this. One of the great things that they can't do is take away the governor's role in redistricting in 2021, which is going to be hugely important. So I think people are going to stay there. I think the focus is going to be very much on the coming election already. I think this has really gotten people realizing we have to continue at it, and we have to change the nature of who's over there, that basically the party that has been in power is just actually really discredited itself.
Rabbi Margulies, one of the things that we mentioned is the problem of gerrymandering. I'm not there. I don't know the exact number, but it seemed as if in aggregate, many, many more people voted for the Democrats than the Republicans. And yet, I think I heard this, that the Republicans actually picked up seats in the legislature.
Insane.
Right?
That's just insane.
It seems like the antithesis of what anybody would call democracy.
That's exactly right. I mean, this whole thing has been a direct assault on democracy. And you're right, there were more Democratic votes cast statewide than Republican, and yet the Republicans gained seats in both the Senate and the Assembly. And, you know, that's part of our frustration. And we're all looking forward to the new census and being able to repair the district maps the way the maps are drawn. That's another thing that's, you know, been in the courts, and we're waiting to hear what the outcome of that litigation will be. But it's been just blatant how the Republicans have drawn the map in their favor, and we see the results so clearly in this last election. But absolutely, everybody is looking toward 2020, and even prior to this election, it was kind of, we're going to get through 2018, and then we're going to focus really on 2020, and, you know, we just have to keep mobilizing our people.
May I interrupt you on that point? What exactly do you mean? Do you mean attacking gerrymandering? Do you mean going to the courts or some sort of a direct action?
Hey, this is Jay Heck. Let me just say that, you know, with regard to the gerrymandering, far more people in Wisconsin understand this is the case 5 or 6 years when we began to talk about it. People get that their vote is de-emphasized because of the way the districts have been drawn. Democrats have been packed into far fewer districts. Republicans have been spread out over the state so that they can maintain a permanent majority for 10 years from 2011 to 2021. People now understand this issue. And there is a huge movement that is pushing for an alternative system. And that system would be modeled after what our neighboring state of Iowa has, which is a nonpartisan legislative bureau draws the map according to a set of very strict criteria. And that's gaining great momentum. And, you know, I don't think we can depend on the federal courts now to uphold the federal court ruling that struck Wisconsin's 2011 lines down because of the ascension of Neil Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court. So this is something Wisconsinites are going to have to accomplish, and we're going to do it. We're going to push, and we're going to make sure that every member of the Wisconsin legislature knows that this is a priority issue in the years ahead.
We're talking with Jay Heck. He is the executive director of Common Cause in Wisconsin. We're also talking from Milwaukee with David Liners, state director of Wisdom, a statewide organization seeking justice and common good. And we're also joined from Madison by Rabbi Bonnie Margulis. She is the president of Wisconsin Faith Voices for Justice. I want to talk about the limitations on the power as a result of this Republican sort of, I don't know what we're going to call it, legislative coup for the attorney general in the state of Wisconsin. I thought I heard somewhere that a Republican-led committee would have to approve any settlement that the new attorney general might make or approve of initiated litigation on the attorney general's part. Is that correct, David?
Actually, I'll let Jay and Bonnie be a little bit more up to date on this. Some bits of that did get dropped out that were originally planned. I mean, the first plan would have completely basically taken over all the decision making from the attorney general. I'm not sure which parts remained and which parts didn't.
Yeah, so what happened was the original version of the bill basically told the attorney general, sit down in the corner and don't talk. And the legislature took over the power to appoint attorneys for any litigation. And so the bill was amended before it passed so that the attorney general now is not completely cut out of the ability to bring suit against the federal government for things like the Affordable Care Act. But the legislature reserved to themselves the power to additionally hire their own attorneys, which to my mind could bring up the ridiculous scenario where we could have our state attorney general representing the state of Wisconsin in a suit on one side and our legislature hiring private attorneys to enter the same suit on the opposite side. and both at taxpayer expense. So it's just a ridiculous way to try to govern. But yes, you're right. One of the other provisions was that the Attorney General has to go to the legislature for approval on any settlements, on any lawsuits. And the bill also takes funding that you would get from a lawsuit, and instead of going to the Department of Justice as it has done, instead will go into the general fund. So instead of it being able to use potentially to, you know, to give settlements to people who were affected in a suit, instead it could be redirected to some other use.
David Liners, a lot of the various press outlets in Wisconsin have made a point that the courts are the obvious next step to challenge these new laws. But several law professors interviewed, and I've seen this a number of times, have said that's not as easy as it sounds, because if this were a federal issue, it would be clearly unconstitutional. It's not a federal issue. It's a state issue. And the law isn't exactly as clear. Do you think that there's a chance that you may not get justice in this case, even if it goes to the courts?
I have, kind of as Bonnie said before, the worst thing is it's probably just going to be there for months and months and maybe even years, and it's going to go around and there's going to be battles over who has jurisdiction, whether this goes to the state Supreme Court or whether it goes to whether it can go to federal courts. So I would say what I expect is that it's going to cost us a lot of money and a lot of time, and I'm not sure, you know, where it's going to end up. It's going to be very muddy, and it's going to be it's just going to chew up a lot of time and a lot of money.
I wonder what's the impact on the broader electorate here. People who are Democrats are energized. There's a Republican base that's energized. There are, though, independent voters or swing voters. Wisconsin went narrowly for Donald Trump in the 2016 election. What's the mood in Wisconsin, or what's your own sense of the mood? If the election were held today, the next presidential election, would Donald Trump win once again? And secondly, do these kind of power play maneuvers by the state Republicans have an impact, say, on swing voters such that they would think, hey, this is, in fact, a power play, the antithesis of democracy? What's your view on that?
This is Jay Heck. You know, the independents did swing to Trump in 2016. It was also, the problem in 2016 was also a horrible campaign run by Hillary Clinton's people. She never came to Wisconsin. So, but what happened in the 2018 elections, just on November 6th, is independents swung heavily for Tony Evers and for Josh Call. And I think this swing towards Trump in 2016 was largely temporary, because many of those counties, particularly in western Wisconsin, had been very much for President Obama in 2008, and then increasingly in 2012. I think there was some frustration with Clinton in 2016, but they seem to have come back. And my guess is that if the progressive forces keep organizing and keep the pressure on, and then keep focusing on the 2019 Supreme Court election, and continue to get people the necessary photo ID that you have to have in Wisconsin. By the way, the second most restrictive photo ID law in the nation. That if those things, if we focus on those things, then we can prevent this wild swing back to Trump as occurred in 2016.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's really heartening from 2018 is the tremendous voter turnout. It was unbelievable. And that really does show how much the electorate has woken up and been mobilized and realized the importance of voting. And in Dane County, it was an unbelievable 92% turnout. So I think that also will make a difference from 2016, that people understand now they have to go out and vote.
That's really something. How important was the 6 week early voting period for that? Now the Republicans are trying to shorten it to 2 weeks.
It was very important in Milwaukee and Dane County. In Milwaukee and Dane County, there were many, many people that voted up to 6 weeks earlier. So it's one of the reasons why the turnout was so tremendous. And the Republicans argued that it's not fair that those two big counties with a lot of Democratic voters should have so much democracy. So they passed this measure that only 2 weeks out can you early vote. It was a deliberate and obvious attempt to cut down on the progressive and democratic turnout in the state's two largest counties. Everybody gets that.
I want to ask the three of you, we only have about 2 minutes left. I mean, you can do these kind of maneuvers like shorten the voting period and so on. But if people are politically engaged and if the demographics are shifting and changing, doesn't it seem like this is a lost cause ultimately, even though the Republicans are these right-wing Republicans are, you know, they're carrying out acts that slow things down, cost a lot of money, frustrate people's will. But when you look at the big trend, it seems like a last-ditch effort on their part. Anyway, let's get all three of you about 30 seconds each.
Early voting in Milwaukee was incredibly important. We did a lot of canvassing, and it takes a while to get people's attention and to start getting people out and get the excitement going. But I do think that what they're doing is just causing a lot of pain and hurting a lot of people and hurting a lot of poor people for two more years. I agree. I think the momentum is there. The other thing I'd point out is that our U.S. Senator, Tammy Baldwin, who's very progressive, won by a huge margin in this same election. So I think there's such a clear message, and I do think that it is going to continue forward. And it's just, what's horrible is that they're just prolonging pain and creating pain for people for two more years, and just because they can.
Clearly, they understand that the demographics are against them in the long run, which is why they are so panicked and why they are pushing through these extreme measures. But David's absolutely right. In the meantime, so many people are going to be hurt.
And Jay Heck, last word.
This power grab by the Republicans has been described as sort of the last gasp of the conservative dominance over Wisconsin. I think that is true. I think not only demographics, but I think the energy and the fact that this has woken up Wisconsinites. I think it means that we're going to return to our progressive tradition, and I think we're going to see it beginning in 2019 in the critical Supreme Court election, and so I'm optimistic about the future, actually, not pessimistic.
Wisconsin does have a very, very long-standing progressive tradition.
Sure does. Robert LaFollette.
That's true. We're out of time. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Lots to talk about, as usual. I'm going to skip around a little bit, if that's okay with you. There was a piece in every major paper this week about criminal justice reform and whether or not it's really reform. So a bill was finally voted on in the Senate. There hasn't been action in the House yet, and it's a bipartisan bill, but people on the left are not so happy with it, even though it was co-sponsored by Hakeem Jeffries, who's very progressive and is going to enter the Democratic leadership in the House next month. Paul, start us off by telling us about this and why it's not so popular.
Well, I think that the main reason it's not so popular is that it's happening under President Trump's watch. I think if this had been happening under President Obama's watch, it would be wildly popular among some people. And it's funny that the people that, you know, embrace the notion of tiny incrementalism and minute improvements and stuff are coming out against this. But I kind of agree with the fact that I don't think it's any real criminal justice reform in the sense that, you know, having watched all the negative and reactionary criminal justice reform that's happened in this country in the last 30 years, starting with, you know, the Federal Crime Control Act of 1994, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, all these laws that have had a hugely negative effect on both the rights of prisoners as well as that have directly and indirectly resulted in the doubling of our prison population, the more than doubling of our prison population. Yeah, this bill doesn't do anything to address any of those things. But I think that's also the thing, too, is that any time the rolling back of prisoners' rights and the massive expansion of the police state has come in, you know, breathtaking, sweeping laws and enactments, none of which are being challenged by this. And it is some minor stuff, but that's also the poverty of vision, I think, of the people that espouse criminal justice reform. You know, no one's talking about repealing or reversing the Prison Litigation Reform Act. No one's talking about repealing or undoing the 1994 Federal Crime Control Act, or the ones that have passed every 2 years since the 1950s. Some of the stuff that is in the criminal justice bill that I think in and of themselves would be worth supporting just as a standalone measure, I think are one of the things that would clarify that federal prisoners can indeed get 54 days off their sentences rather than the 47 that the Bureau of Prisons currently gives them. But I'm kind of surprised why this needs an actual bill and why that can't just be done by executive order, because this is just an agency interpretation. You don't need an act of Congress to do that. Arguably, Congress already spoke when they enacted the law in 1987, when they enacted the Sentencing Reform Act. And arguably, if you actually want to do something about good time, you know, rather than just do, you know, reinforcing the 54 days a week that Congress enacted in 1987 rather than the 47 they've actually been getting, why not, you know, give federal prisoners real good time incentives, like reducing their sentences by a third or by half or by more than a paltry 7 days, the 7 days difference between 47 and 54 days. So I think there's definitely a lot of, you know, there's a lot of criticisms of the law that they don't even touch on the whole issue of prisoner rights. Again, like the issue of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which is, you know, pretty much eviscerated what few rights prisoners had in terms of court access. The Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which pretty much eliminated the potential for habeas review. You know, these are all kind of like structural laws that have been in place for the last 25 or 30 years that have led to the massive expansion of the police state. And these are not being touched by, you know, these are not being touched by this bill. But I think that to say that it's a step in the wrong direction, I think that's a bit harsh. I mean, I think certainly for prisoners who would be positively impacted by something as modest, as tiny, as, you know, just having their good time days increased from 47 to 54, I think for the people affected, that, you know, that is a difference. And again, like I say, the people that are opposing it, normally these are the people who view any tiny, modest thing as part of an incrementalist agenda because they lack a vision of anything better that can be done.
Well, that's part of the problem too, Paul. Actually, I should ask Kevin about this too. Paul makes a whole bunch of good points here. And in addition, this new bill doesn't do anything about mandatory minimum sentences, and it doesn't allow judges to have greater leeway in sentencing. So is that really reform? If it doesn't actually change sentences in any way, plus, you know, there hasn't been federal parole since, 1986. If they really wanted to reform the system, they would start spending money again on job training or on education and reinstitute parole.
Well, I think the vast majority of politicians don't want to stake their political careers on actually reforming the system, because we know that some of the most vicious campaign ads involve individual cases that purport to address systemic issues that usually are non-existent, you know, blowing up violent criminal cases in order to stick them to your name so that it's difficult for you to win back your seat. It's the most common, at least from Republicans, it's one of the most common forms of attack ads. Perhaps, you know, in honor of George H.W. Bush, you know, him and his kind perfected that kind of ad early in the 1980s and onward. That's possibly why we don't see sentencing reform. And I think, honestly, Paul's on to, and I don't need to go over it again, but I would echo what he's saying about how a lot of reform should probably start with the Prison Litigation Reform Act, because then you're giving prisoners the ability to defend themselves from the sort of egregious actions that are happening that we talk about weekly on this show. A very small amount of people are going to be affected by this legislation were it to be signed into law. And I think the one other thing that needs to be focused on is who wants this legislation to be passed. With the Koch brothers being very adamant about its passage, with other private interest groups wanting to see this legislation pass, they didn't simply become compassionate people who want to see people have a shot at redemption and get out of prison. They see an opportunity for making money off of these individuals. And I think you know, this column that you had us look at before the show about that was in the New York Times points to groups like the Geo Group that stand to profit from electronic monitoring solutions in the aftermath of this legislation. It talks about increasing electronic monitoring systems that private corporations have created to track people, surveillance, controlling those who are released. Talks about home detention programs, post-release transitional programs, you know, these sort of ankle bracelets, the proliferation of what we could call digital incarceration in this current day is what we're looking at here, that this bill is not necessarily going to create conditions for. I mean, they are already there, but it's going to help those people who are out there to make money off of families who are incarcerated and are saying to them, well, you don't have to be in jail. You could be with your family, but we're still going to we'll bill you for these certain services, and then you'll have to pick up the tab for them. They can make money off of incarcerated people.
That's the voice of Kevin Gostala. We're talking to Kevin and Paul Wright in our weekly segment. It's every Thursday called Criminal Injustice. John, we talked a little bit earlier in the week about what Kevin just mentioned regarding George H.W. Bush, but for people who may have missed that segment, I'll just remind people, George H.W. Bush set up a drug buy in Lafayette Park. I mean, his speechwriter suggested it to him. It was September 1989. I'm reading from Michael Isikoff, September 22nd, 1989. White House speechwriters thought it was the perfect visual for President Bush's first primetime address to the nation. A dramatic prop that would show how the drug trade had spread to the president's own neighborhood. Quote, "This is crack cocaine," Bush solemnly announced, holding up a plastic bag filled with a white, chunky substance in his September 5th speech on drug policy. Quote, "It was seized a few days ago in a park across the street from the White House. It could have easily been heroin or PCP. But obtaining the crack," this is now Michael Isikoff, "but obtaining the crack was no easy feat. To match the words crafted by the speechwriters, Drug Enforcement Administration agents lured a suspected district drug dealer to Lafayette Park 4 days before the speech so they could make what appears to have been the agency's first undercover crack buy in a park better known for its location right across the street from the White House. In fact, when first contacted by an undercover DEA agent posing as a drug buyer, the teenage suspect seemed baffled by the agent's request. Quote, where the F is the White House? He replied in a conversation that was secretly tape recorded by the DEA. Quote, we had to manipulate him to get him down there, said William McMullen, assistant special agent in charge of the DEA's Washington field office. It wasn't easy. I mean, yes, what happened to that teenage suspect who was a prop? He went to prison. And so did a lot of people afterwards, Paul. We went from the rate of incarceration, I think, in the 80s was 1 million. By the time Bill Clinton left office 10 years after this drug bust set up by George H.W. Bush, the number had risen to about 2 million. Let's talk about all of that.
Yes, and I think a lot of this was just driven by laws. Among them, I wrote at the time when the 1994 federal crime bill was passed. It's today a lot of people remember it as eliminating Pell Grants so prisoners can't get a higher education. But among the things it did, it massively expanded the federal death penalty. They'd added 50 or 60 new crimes to it. But some of the more corrosive effects about it that led to the massive expansion of mass incarceration were that it gave states prison building grants. It gave states billions of dollars to build prisons if they enacted sentencing reforms that reduced the amount of time that prisoners could earn off their sentences and lengthened the amount of time they did in prison to 85%. So basically, states that changed their laws to make prisoners and criminal defendants serve 80% of their sentences got billions of dollars in prison construction grants. And, you know, this is still in place. This hasn't changed. And no one's talking about eliminating that. That was just one of many, many aspects of the 1994 federal crime control bill. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, in terms of, you know, President Clinton signed it into law, Bernie Sanders voted for it. This law passed the House by a two-vote margin, and Bernie Sanders was among the people that voted for it. And I think it's one of those things is that all these bad things that have come down the pike in the bad from the prisoner perspective or criminal defendants and a human rights perspective, all the stuff that's come down the pike, whether it's the 1994 Federal Crime Control Bill, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, all these laws, they've passed with bipartisan majorities. You know, it wasn't like there was some principled opposition to them. The only thing that engendered some opposition to the 1994 crime control bill was that it had a ban on assault weapons. And so a number of Republicans opposed it on that basis. But the good news and the bad news was that the assault weapons ban had a sunset clause in it. So that automatically expired after 10 years. But all the other stuff, the ban on Pell Grants, the expansion of the federal death penalty, the prison building grants, all this other stuff, that stayed. That did not have a sunset clause in it. So here we are, you know, 25 years later, and we're still stuck with all those portions. But the one part of the law that did generate opposition, the assault weapons ban, that's long since gone. That's come and gone. That's history. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, this kind of illustrates, I think, the poverty of any type of discussion of what passes for discourse in this country about the need for criminal justice reform is that I think, you know, Kevin makes the good points about, you know, things that are going to be expanded under this law, like the electronic caging. And I think it's worth noting that for the past 30 years, everything that's been touted or promoted as a prison diversion process has actually served to increase the prison population, because no one is getting these so-called reform measures. No one is not going to prison as a result of this. What's happening, rather, is that people that would not have gone to prison in the first place are getting fed into these systems, which then in turn impose very rigorous surveillance and other restrictions. The reality is most people, especially poor people that are often economically marginalized, cannot comply with. And everyone knows they can't comply with it. So it's just a feeder system into the prison system so that people who 30 years ago would have gotten a non-carceral sentence, today they get a jail sentence. The people that would have gotten a jail sentence 30 years ago, today they're going to prison. And people that are going to prison in the first place, they're just going for much longer periods of time. But I think that that's part of the problem, though, is that it acts as a feeder system so that people that would not have been subject to this type of surveillance, would not have been subject to probation, surveillance, or jail in the first place, now they get put on electronic surveillance. Most people know that they're going to fail the terms of the surveillance, of the terms of their release, and they're just going to wind up in prison sooner or later on a parole violation or a probation violation due to the surveillance. And it serves to feed into the prison system.
You know, let me add something to that, too. And I know this is just, you know, one personal story, but I think it's indicative of the problem with the system. My closest friend in prison, Mark Lanzalotti, and we're still friends. He was a first-time nonviolent drug offender. He was involved in a conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamine. He was the only person who voluntarily left the conspiracy. So, to make a long story short, everybody was busted. Everybody but Mark cooperated because he didn't want to be accused of being a rat. Everybody got 5.5 years except for Mark. Mark had the least to do with the manufacturing of this meth, but he got triple life without parole because of mandatory minimum sentencing. And the judge apologized profusely at his sentencing. I've seen the transcripts. Even his prosecutor apologized, and then the prosecutor worked over the next 17 years to get him out of prison. Finally, because of Barack Obama's clemency project, Mark was released. He was released after having served 17 years in prison.
So when was he arrested then?
He was arrested in 1999. Now, the problem is, and it's great that he's out. Now he's a successful real estate agent. God bless him. But the problem is that those laws are still on the books. The law hasn't changed at all.
And no one's talking about changing them.
Exactly. So the next guy who decides he doesn't want to testify gets all these enhancements for not testifying, for not, quote unquote, taking responsibility for your crime. And the next guy is going to get triple life without parole. That's not reform.
Well, and like I say, that just kind of goes to, I think, the poverty of vision that, and again, on a bipartisan basis, you know, we don't see like anyone's really positing, you know, the repeal of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which the Human Rights Defense Center has long advocated, you know, literally since the day it was enacted. Or, you know, the notion of prisoners having meaningful access to the courts is something that no one likes across the political spectrum. And that's part of the reason is because for the last 40 or 50 years, the only real meaningful criminal justice reform that's happened in this country has been through the court system. And it hasn't been through the legislatures. It hasn't been through the executive branch.
That was the voice of Paul Wright. We're talking to Paul Wright. He's talking to us from Florida. We're also talking from Chicago with Kevin Gostala in this segment of Loud and Clear called Criminal Injustice. We talk every Thursday about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. Kevin Gostala, let's go into another story. I'm looking at one of the headlines, Arizona inmates allege civil rights abuses in the aftermath of deadly Yuma prison riot. That's a shocking story, but not surprising. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, so we have another instance here where there was a disturbance and the Arizona Department of Corrections responded to it. It led to, you know, a kind of a rebellion. These are, you know, again, we have to understand that every single one of the facilities in our country are tinderboxes that are waiting to explode. And understandably, because we talk about these grievances every single week, and they always remain within the system. These are always things that people within these facilities are dealing with on a daily basis. So anything that happens that can pop off, that can be the match that starts the fire. And that's figurative. I mean, that doesn't mean that they're setting things ablaze every single time that there's some kinds of disturbance. So let's be clear about that for any correctional wardens or whatever that might be peering into this show. But like every single week, you know, that we talk about this, I think it's important to remember that we've talked about the national strike. We've talked about efforts on the parts of prisoners to actually engage in nonviolent resistance. We've talked about efforts around work stoppages. We've talked about things that are done. We frequently referred to jailhouse lawyers, prisoners who spend their time in jail learning about the law and try to work on their cases and then help others with their cases. And wardens of facilities really do not like these people and want to suppress them. And so when you see instances like this, not all the time, but I just say generally, when you're looking at these kinds of issues that ultimately develop into riots, they become opportunities for prisoners to have some power and not feel powerless for a brief amount of time. And that's usually in response to ongoing repression that has been happening daily. And in this case, we'd be talking about the Arizona state prison system.
Guys, we are running a little bit short on time because we get so wrapped up in these important issues, we lose track of it. So let's move on to jury selection. There was a piece in the New York Times entitled, "Yes, Jury Selection is as Racist as You Think. Now We Have Proof." And I saw it in one of your emails, Paul, that you sent around today. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I guess basically we've known for a long time that prosecutors use, you know, they use the jury selection method to keep racial minorities off of juries. That's been a huge issue. The Supreme Court has addressed it. You know, the Supreme Court has addressed it in a case called the Batson decision, where they held that prosecutors cannot strike jurors based on, you know, based on their race. And anyways, but so the New York Times reports that they reports on a study that shows that statewide prosecutors use what's called peremptory challenges. Those are the basis by which either side, the prosecutor or the defense, can eliminate jurors without saying a reason. You know, the prosecutor or the defense lawyer can say, "Hey, I just don't like the way the person looks. I don't like single moms on the jury. I don't like postal employees on the jury," or whatever. And they can strike jurors for any reason as long as it's not race-based. In other words, as long as they're not striking people based on, you know, as long as it's not based on their race, which would go against the Supreme Court decision in Batson. So what the study showed was that statewide, prosecutors in North Carolina remove around 20% of African Americans that are in the jury pool compared with 10% of white people. And conversely, it's interesting that defense lawyers representing criminal defendants then remove more white jurors, around 22%, than black jurors of the 10% that are left in the jury pools that are left by the judge and the prosecutor. So, and of course, it shows one of the things that the study also showed was that prosecutors in urban areas that have more minority populations remove non-white jurors at a faster rate or a higher rate than prosecutors do in more rural and whiter parts of the state. And you know, the thing is, though, this isn't really a surprise. I mean, I think anyone that is familiar with the criminal justice system knows, you know, the extraordinary lengths at which prosecutors go to remove racial and other minorities from juries. In fact, occasionally over the years, prosecutorial handbooks have come to light, which I know folks remember. Lynn Abraham had a manual, and when she was the prosecutor in Philadelphia, where she sent dozens of defendants to death row, and you know, she explicitly stated that she expected her prosecutors to remove black people from juries in Philadelphia. You know, there's been a lot of these manuals that have come out from all parts of the country, too, not just the South, as in North Carolina in this case, but Philadelphia, California, Florida, and other places where prosecutors explicitly tell the prosecutors trying cases to get racial and in some cases religious minorities out of juries so that, you know, you get more conviction-prone, more police-friendly juries that are likely to believe what prosecutors have to say.
Kevin, let's move over to you. California is modifying its felony murder law, and what this is going to do is help up to 800 prisoners who are currently serving life sentences to have a chance at parole. California frequently leads in this kind of thing, but with that said, the prisons there are just full to bursting. And California has a lot of people, hundreds of people on death row, even if they don't execute people. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, actually, Paul might be able to explain this better, but what I know of the felony murder law is that this is something that prosecutors have used to basically tie people to murders who didn't actually commit these murders. And then they go to jail, and then they're, it's basically this way of like, building out a conspiracy, the very thing that prosecutors do in order to incarcerate people who probably shouldn't be incarcerated for crimes, period. And it basically allows them to maximize their effect. And so you can see how having that kind of a law on the books allows for mass incarceration, because you're basically manufacturing crimes to put people in jail. And then in this sense, as you're talking about with California, I mean, what we can say right now about California statewide is that, you know, they've, as you're saying, they've constantly had pressure with overcrowding. They've constantly had issues. We've talked about in the northern parts of the state, we've been following issues up there with prison psychologists and mental health care treatment. We know the kinds of pressures that they have up there as far as health care go. And I think that, you know, what you have is, and this goes back to the First Step Act, connects back to what we talked about earlier on the show. What you have is lawmakers who like to tinker around the edges and find ways that they can remove little things from the system that the system doesn't really need to be a mass incarceration system. I mean, technically, you can still do everything that the system does without having this law. And that's ultimately why you can reform it and take it off the books. And we just have dozens of these. I mean, it coming from the legacy of Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, and so on. And even you can go back as far as Nixon, you know, having some of these laws for the war on drugs, to be tough on crime, et cetera, they just seem so extraneous now. But even when you remove them, what you find is you still have a very rich tapestry, so to speak, of different laws available for prosecutors to punish people to the maximum. And again, still incarcerate more people than, there's no decarceration in this country. We're not reducing people. We're allowing for a status quo to be maintained.
Okay, let's close this out with something a little bit unusual. There's a website called splinternews.com, and they have a post that's very interesting and very different. I think it's very important. It's entitled Send a Holiday Card to a Prison Rape Survivor, and they've got this fascinating side-by-side picture. There's a woman standing in front of a wall, and she's kind of looking down, and it says, if this woman were being raped, would you help her? And then in the next picture, it's the same woman, it's the same picture, but she's wearing a prison uniform. And it says, how about now? And it talks about how rape is a common thing in prison, and prisons are dangerous places. And oftentimes, both women and men who are victims of sexual assaults in prison, sometimes by correctional officers and sometimes by other prisoners, just are forgotten. So this is a chance to send a holiday card to somebody who is certainly not expecting it and might lift their day. So again, if you want to check it out, it's www.splinternews.com. So we will leave it there. Until next week, we were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. Kevin is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. And Paul also edits Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back with a lot more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.